IsraelSin.com.
Richard Landis, we're sitting in Jerusalem, and you came along a while ago and uncovered a plot of sorts called the Eldura of the Eldura story. For those of you who don't remember, Muhammad Eldura was a young boy who, together with his father, was cowering behind a 50-gallon drum while being theoretically shot at and eventually killed by Israeli soldiers. All this captured on television by the French television channel France 2. And it was then, I understand, very generously given free to all the media outlets in the world. And Richard Landis was one of the first people to realize that this was a fraud. And I'm wondering, Richard, what was it that gave you that signal?
Well, actually, what's interesting is I'm not one of the first people to come into this. I came into it in the summer of 2003, and already there had been an investigation. There were a number of Israelis, including particularly Nachum Shachaf and the director of the news agency, Matula News Agency, Stefan Juffa, who had worked on this. They had put out a movie. They had been in touch with a German documentary maker, Esther Shapira. She had put out a movie. And then James Fallows wrote an article on this. And it's the article that I read in the Atlantic Monthly in the summer of June 2003. That alerted me to this. And then I went to Paris for the summer. I was doing research, met with the people who had made the movie, Gérard Hubert, who had actually just come out with a book that summer on the affair. So there were a lot of people, Nidra Poehler and so on. A lot of people had already caught on to this, but they were really having enormous difficulty making it go anywhere. Even James Fallows, that was sort of the high point of reaching the mainstream media, Atlantic Monthly. But Fallows never followed up on it. I don't know this for certain, but I think he got a lot of flack for doing it. One of the things that I'm beginning to realize, I heard a talk by Daniel Dayan at a conference that I just attended and spoke at, and he talked about how some of these narratives are actually sacred narratives. And Eldura is unquestioned in the Arab world, unquestionably. He's a martyr. It's a sacred narrative. I showed a copy of this to an Arab reporter, and I said, don't show it to anybody yet. It's not done. He said, are you kidding? If I'm caught with this guy's a martyr. If I'm caught with this, I'm dead. So it's a sacred narrative in the Arab and the Muslim world, but it's also a sacred narrative in the West. It is the sacred narrative of all those who want to compare Israel to the Nazis, all those for whom, as the Nazis used to say about the Jews, Israel is our misfortune, who want to believe that if only we could sort of throw Israel to the Arab world, then they would be satisfied and leave us alone. So it's a tremendously important narrative, and it's also very important. It's sacred to the Israeli left. I mean, that's the really astonishing thing. I just gave a talk at Mishkanot about this, and apparently my presentation was successful because a professor of political science and communications says, okay, so what if it's staged? We've killed over 100 of their children. What's one more or less? So now, you know, I can understand that coming from Gideon Levy, says that kind of thing, Tom Segev said, but this guy's a professor of political science and communication whose specialty is stuff like the role of the media in the peace process. And if he doesn't understand that this story and this alleged killing before a camera, as far as I know, it's the only case of a child. You see a child die on screen, shot, murdered by an army. I don't think that exists outside, certainly not in this conflict, and I don't even think that exists outside of this conflict. So it's an absolutely unique picture, had an incredible impact psychologically. I argue that it's a modern blood libel. And he's saying to me, what's one more or less? It's an astounding phenomenon. The only way I can explain it is that it's a sacred narrative. So in terms of 2003, you know, this stuff was coming out, but it wasn't going anywhere because it violated this sacred narrative that was so important to so many people, including the media, for whom the frame of the Arab-Israeli conflict is the Israeli Goliath and the Palestinian David. And this, you know, this is a fake, doesn't work. Actually, I showed it to my class once, and there was one student who said, you know, you've completely convinced me, but I'm reluctant to agree with you. And I said, why? She said, because I feel that if I agree with you, I'm siding with the Israelis, and I don't want to take sides. So, you know, you've got this phenomenon of, you know, I can't allow reality in because it violates whatever moral commitments I already have. And I think that that's one of the real tragedies of this story.
You came to the story from your professional point of view. Could you tell us a little bit about how that worked?
Yeah, I mean, even before I read the Fallows article, I was already aware that this story was had an enormous impact, and particularly through my contacts in France. I mean, I'm a French historian, a medievalist, no less. So, you know, my French Jewish friends complained bitterly about how this was shown all the time, about how this woman, Catherine, who's a major figure. She's written books about the political process in France. She's the equivalent of a Dan Rather or a Bob Simon or something. And her comment on TV, on her own program, was, this picture replaces the picture of the little boy in the ghetto, in the Warsaw ghetto. So, you know, you have the Europeans, or the Arab world, I found out later, Bin Laden made a recruiting movie using this footage. I did know that when Daniel Pearl was executed in Pakistan by a Western-educated Pakistani jihadi, they had a picture in their video that they put up, the first, you know, execution video put up on the internet in 2002. They interwove the execution with pictures of Muhammad al-Dura. So I was already aware that, whether this were true or not, and I didn't think the Israelis shot the kid on purpose, but I did think, like everybody else, that they probably hit him by accident. I mean, that's what we were told. Who are we to think that the media would be so stupid as to fall for an out-and-out fake? So I assumed that the Israelis had killed him by accident. That's what the Israelis assumed, and apologized. But I did know that the thing was operating as a blood libel. As a medievalist, I know about blood libels. I know that when you tell a story about a Jews deliberately killing a Gentile boy, very important that it be a boy, killing a Gentile boy, and that the response to that is to consider all Jews everywhere responsible for that murder, you're dealing with a blood libel. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, I just gave a talk at Herzliya, and a young French woman came up to me. She said, you know, I was 17 at the time. I was going to a non-Jewish school, and the next day, I can't tell you how many people came up to me and said, why did you kill that kid? And that's what Philippe Calsanti, who's on trial now in Paris for this, also said. He came to work, and one of his employees, you know, just let him have it. You know, how could you have killed that kid? And the attacks on Jews in Belgium, a rabbi who didn't even know what happened because it was Rosh Hashanah and he wasn't watching TV, got attacked by, he was walking to a synagogue through an Arab neighborhood, and they assaulted him because of what happened to Muhammad al-Dura. So this is a devastating story. And for an Israeli professor of political science and communication to say to me, oh, what does it matter whether it was staged or not, one more or less makes no difference, is staggering. I mean, it's literally a staggering position for a responsible intellectual who's not Jewish to take, but for a Jewish intellectual to take it, it's literally mind-boggling, who's supposedly a humanist and who supposedly, in principle, cares about the truth, right? And you know, one would think that he would be somewhat protective of the state of Israel. I mean, one of the things that Daniel Dayan, in the same conference, French sociologist Daniel Dayan spoke, and he said, you know, one of the things that happens is, he had a good line, he said, pity is a bad mathematician, it only knows one. But then it does this algebraic transformation in which the one becomes symbolic of the all. So you've got a case in which we have no documented case where an Israeli soldier deliberately kills an innocent child. But you have this staged case of an Israeli soldier deliberately killing an innocent child, which becomes the symbol of all other children. So when he says, what difference does it make whether one more or less, what he's actually doing is affirming in the minds of many that those 800 kids who were killed in the course of the Intifada are all young, are all innocent, and are all deliberately killed by the Israelis. So it's a radical distortion of the real situation, a complete misrepresentation of what these figures mean. And he's not even, not only is he not ready to defend his own nation, but he's eager to help demonize it. And this is not, you know, he's not a traitor. He's just part of a mentality. I think what I would say, what's become clear to me is that, and I think Al-Dura plays a key role in this, to use postmodern, postcolonial language, the Palestinian demonizing narrative of the Israelis has managed to colonize the Jewish imagination. There are lots of Jews who have internalized this story, who believe it, who take that 800 as symbolic of all the sins that the Israeli army has committed, and for whom this is in some sense become a sacred narrative. Now, this is really disastrous. And it's not just disastrous for the Jews. It's not just disastrous for Israel. It's disastrous for the world. Because if you think of your average non-Jew out there, a good liberal in California or in Iowa or anywhere, if he looks at the conflict and the Palestinians are saying the Israelis are like the Nazis, and then you get people like this who are responsible authorities, well-educated, who say, well, we're not like Nazis, but we've done terrible things. How is he supposed to know that the actuality is the inverse? How is an American supposed to know that the Israeli army has much higher standards of trying to avoid civilian casualties than the American army does in Iraq? How is anybody outside of Israel to understand that by impartial standards, Israel has the most ethical army in the world, when the media portrays it as if it's the most brutal army in the world, and the Israelis aren't even ready to defend it because, in their mind, it's not moral enough? I mean, that's the amazing thing. If you speak to this professor, he will tell you, I don't care what the American army does. I don't care what the British army does. I only care what the Israeli army does, and it's not doing a good enough job. Well, okay, you know, if you're in a classroom and you got a guy who's brilliant and who's getting an A and he's killing himself to get an A+, and you can barely get a C, if he's willing to say, I don't really deserve this A, you might be willing to say, okay, yeah, you don't deserve it. I mean, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Jewish self-criticism is not, I mean, Jewish self-criticism is great. It's what makes Judaism such an extraordinarily powerful and effective, nonviolent religion. But there's a pathological form which is not only terrible for the Jews, it's terrible for the rest of the world and for the Palestinians. No one holds them to any standards. And they're not held to standards because the enemy they have is only too willing to say, we're at fault.
Why is it that the blood libel has to be a boy?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It's something that early on, actually, listen, I mean, I think there are a couple of cases of girls. It's something that Norman Cohn, who had psychoanalytic training, pointed out in his study. And it's an actually interesting detail because it's consistently a boy. And I think that it has to do with a number of things. And one of the things that it has to do with is a terrible confusion that certainly in the Middle Ages Gentiles had about Jews. Because Jews don't fit in medieval society, and really well into the 19th and the 20th century, you weren't a man unless you killed another man. I mean, that's how you became a man. You fought. And if you didn't fight, like priests, then somehow you were a woman. And there are beliefs in the Middle Ages that the Jews, for whom killing another man is far from the sign of manhood, there are myths that Jewish men menstruated. So there's this whole problem of what is a Jewish male? What is he doing? And I think that the assault of the Jews, this fantasy that behind this meek and mild exterior of the non-warrior Jewish male lies this sort of hidden vicious male, and therefore, you know, the taking of a 12-year-old boy, just as he's reaching puberty, a Gentile boy, and slitting his veins and draining the blood from him and so on. All of this is, in some senses, a sort of symbolic reenactment of this anxiety about castration anxiety on the part of the Gentiles. But that's a... it's a whole different story. Yeah. And again, you know, one of the things that bothers the Arabs enormously is, in the entire history of Islam, Jews have been a dhimmi people. They've been a subject people. They've never fought. They've never been known to fight. And then all of a sudden, in the 20th century, Jews start to fight back, and 3 million Jews in 1967 defeat armies from Arab nations totaling hundreds of millions. And that is an enormous blow to the Arab psyche, to the enormous blow to their sense of manhood and so on. So I think that, you know, Al-Dura, the way that bin Laden uses Al-Dura, which is basically not only to arouse hatred of the West and Israel, but of all Arab and Muslim leaders who are impotent to take vengeance. The way that he uses Al-Dura is clearly a way of sort of getting the blood to rise in the Arab warrior.
What is it about the footage that you find to be fraudulent?
Well, actually,
it's hard to explain.
I know it's hard to explain. Look, the real issue here is we have the footage. It turns out to be only 60 seconds worth of footage, all right? And then we have the narrative. And according to the narrative, and this is what led Charles Onderlin to present it as the boy and the father, target of fire from the Israeli position, killed by another round of fire, is Talal Abu Rahmeh. Well, he tells us the firing went on for 45 minutes. So how much of 45 minutes did he get when he was sheltered the entire time and right across the way, you know, literally across the street from what was happening? He should have gotten a whole bunch. The boy bled for 20 minutes. The ambulance couldn't come and get him. He should have had lots of incredibly valuable footage. And he says, under oath, I took 27 minutes of footage of the shooting. Well, now that we've seen the rushes in the French court, there's no 27 minutes of shooting. We already have seen all of the footage available. So Talal lied. And when you look at the 60 seconds, it breaks down into six different takes of 10 seconds each. Now, I don't understand how a professional photographer ends up only taking 8-second clips of a boy being shot and dying. But if you look at them, each scene is actually constructed. The father shifted positions. The boy shifted positions. The boy's holding his hands over his eyes and not over his stomach where he's supposedly shot. There's no blood on the ground. When I write the book on this, I'm going to call it The Bloodless Libel. There's no blood on the ground. There's no blood on the ground the next day. There's no blood on the father, who was allegedly shot at least 8 times. None on the wall. There are no signs of bullet fire coming from the Israeli position. I mean, there's nothing in the actual footage to support the claim the boy's dead, unless you believe a priori, and suggestion plays a huge role in this, if you believe a priori that you're seeing a boy shot, then you can believe the boy is shot. But once you rid yourself of, once you understand that Talal has lied repeatedly, we have the bullets, he has no bullets, I took a shot of this, he has no shot of this. Once you realize that Talal is systematically lying, and that Charles Onderlin is systematically covering him and really knows nothing. He made a map of the intersection where he had the Israelis on the wrong side for me. And that's 3 years after the event. So, I mean, once you realize the bad faith and incompetence of the people who are telling you what to see, and you just look at what you see, I think, you know, we have no smoking gun, we have no overwhelming proof, we don't have the boy alive today, or if he is, we don't have him. But on the other hand, the odds that this is staged are so high, and the Rube Goldberg machine that you have to invent to explain why Talal didn't take more footage, why it breaks down into these things, why this boy is holding the hand over his eyes and not over his stomach, why there's no blood, why there's no ambulance evacuation, why the dozen other photographers or cameramen who were there that day didn't catch it, even though all they caught was, you know, phony scenes of Pallywood, which I used to make my movie Pallywood. I mean, this is gold. If you understand that they're standing around all day long filming fake scenes of ambulance evacuations because there's no real action, and you finally get real action, and there are a dozen cameramen, and not one of them caught a moment of this scene, it's staggering. And we know that two of them were right there when the father and son were behind the barrel. So it's just, it is so patently fake. And not only is it patently fake, but it's a cheap fake. I mean, if you were teaching film in a school, right, and a student came to you with this and said, here, look at what I did. I filmed this scene of a father and son behind the barrel being shot by Israeli soldiers. You'd have sent him packing. You'd have said, well, at least give the kid a bag of blood and have him break it so that there's blood on the ground. And, you know, and have the father try and protect the son and pull him out of the way of the Israelis. I mean, have these people show some real emotions. Do something. You know, make this realistic. It's a cheap fake. And people were so eager to believe it that it just spread like wildfire. And the resistance to acknowledging it is astounding, including people like prominent Israeli journalists, for whom, so what? You know, one minute they're saying, we killed a boy, it's terrible. When I first started on this, I met this guy named Beit Michael, who's a journalist for, I think, Yediot Ahronot. And I said to him, what do you know about Al-Dura? 100% the Israelis shot him. You know, so on the one hand, they're telling us it's 100% they shot him. And then when you say it's a fake, they say, doesn't matter. You know, I understand the Palestinians saying it doesn't matter, but the Israelis saying it doesn't matter doesn't compute.
What's the update on the case in France?
Well, this is interesting. I mean, I think Charles Ondelin made an enormous mistake when he went to court. I mean, some of the people he picked on were really small fry and easily frightened and, you know, got off more or less, and that was it. They didn't, one guy didn't even want me to use his name in my blog posts. I mean, he was embarrassed. He's a prominent physician. He wasn't interested in having his name dragged into this. But Philippe Carsanti was a mistake. He picked on Philippe Carsanti, and Carsanti is the proverbial bulldog. Once he's got his teeth in your leg, he's not letting go. And Anderlin really made a mistake. So Philippe lost the first trial, but immediately appealed. The others did not appeal. He immediately appealed. And now, well, one of the things was, you know, and this was Anderlin's language, because he had already used it with me repeatedly. The judges in their decision said, look, the Israelis haven't said anything on this. Why should we believe Philippe Carsanti, a private citizen? Since, you know, if the Israelis didn't do it, you know, they'd be the first to defend themselves. And I've heard this, you know, every time I present this in the States, people say, you know, the only thing that doesn't work for your explanation is, your explanation makes every bit of sense, except why haven't the Israelis said anything? So the French court does this. And so finally that gets the Israelis moving. And the Israelis ask to see the tapes, IDF, formal letter. And when that gets to the judge, I think it influenced the appeal court judges saying, I want to see the footage. So they brought the footage to court. That was quite a scene. It was quite a circus. But I would say Anderlin lost that round. And from here on in, it looks very bad. So February 27th, February 27th will be formal presentation of arguments. And that should be interesting, because France, too, has now fired their initial lawyer, who was a very pretty and utterly incompetent. I mean, I don't know if she, maybe she was competent in other things, but in this case, she knew nothing. She asked no questions of the witnesses. She made no effort. I think she was window dressing, and they assumed they'd just sail through. And under Chirac, they did just sail through. But Chirac is no longer prime minister or president. Sarkozy is a different kettle of fish. This appeals court is a judge is a different kettle of fish. And it's very possible. So we'll see, first of all, a more vigorous argument from the side of the France, two people who have now hired Chirac's lawyer as their prime lawyer. Philippe has changed lawyer. He has a more aggressive lawyer. So the February 27th, I wouldn't miss it for the world. February 27th is going to be an interesting arguments, and then I don't know when the decision is going to come. But the big disaster is already for France, too, that, you know, this is now spilling out. I mean, for the longest time, France, too, had control of this story. It was like the emperor's new clothes. You know, people look at the tape and they go, I know it's fake, but I'm afraid to say anything because if I do, I'm going to be marginalized as a kook, a conspiracy nut, which is the kind of accusations that I've gotten all along. So I'm reluctant to say anything. Now, it's more legitimate to say there are some issues here without being immediately called a conspiracy nut and so on. For example, not only have I been asked to give talks here at forums that previously would not have given me the platform, much to France 2's distress, they actually sent their lawyer sent the letter to the people who are holding the talk I gave at Herzliya, telling them not to give it. But already Mabat Sheni, which is Second Look, which is a program in Israel on Channel 1, is now doing something on the Yaldur affair. Now, I went to them 3 years ago and showed them the stuff, and they said, no, we're not going to do anything. But now, with this hook, it's more legitimate to go ahead and do it. So Andelin really has brought his misery on himself, and he richly deserves it.
We're not really concerned with Andelin and his misery. We're far more concerned with Israel and our misery. How do you see this playing itself out in the future, in future encounters and in future conflicts, which are sure to... Yeah. Quite likely to occur.
Right. Yes. No, I mean, this is a predictable thing. And, of course, Al-Dura has a whole series of progeny, probably the biggest being Jenin. But there's also Gaza Beach. There's Kfar Kana. We're doing a movie on Gaza Beach. There have been movies done on Jenin. We hope to do a movie on Kfar Kana and so on. There are two ways in which I think this thing needs to play out. First of all, Al-Dura is only the most powerful example of a much more widespread phenomenon, which I've called Pallywood, in a movie which you can find on YouTube, Pallywood. And Pallywood is essentially staging footage, which you then pass on. You stage it for Palestinian cameramen who have Western equipment, Reuters, AP, BBC, etc., and then they pass that on to reporters like Alan Johnston or Charles Andelin or Bob Simon, who then, I don't even think these guys see the full footage. I mean, I've sat and studied 2 hours of Reuters footage from the 30th of September painstakingly. They don't have time to do that. This stuff goes first to people who basically cut out the most... the unimportant stuff, and they get the juicy stuff, and then they cut that down to 3-4 seconds. They string those incidents together, and then they show this action sequence of all these Palestinians being carried off in ambulances, and then they repeat casualty figures that are ludicrous. I mean, even Israeli TV, for the day Al-Dura was shot, says 5 were killed and hundreds were injured for that day. Okay, now 1 was killed. And he was a Palestinian policeman who was shooting at the Israelis, and a sniper got him. And as far as I can make out, in 2 hours of footage from Reuters, I don't see any. There's one seriously injured person in the entire thing. The rest of the stuff is. So, you know, so if you hear this stuff, you think, oh my God, what's going on down there? So Pallywood is a terribly powerful and terribly noxious phenomenon, and the Israelis must stop it. You saw it in Lebanon. You saw it, Gaza Beach. You know, it's not like it's all fake like Al-Dura. Gaza Beach, a family really got killed, but the evidence is pretty strong that he was killed. They were killed by Palestinian mines that were placed there to keep the Israelis from coming ashore to go after Katyusha launches. And some kid played with it on the beach, and it blew up and killed his family. So, terrible thing, but the Pallywood trick is to blame Israel. So you have this girl, Huda, running back and forth between her father and her family, sobbing hysterically. And there's no question that, you know, her family's dead and she must feel terribly. But she's then being systematically, it's almost a pornography of suffering in which her feelings are being used, exploited to condemn Israel. And the Western media just jumps on it. So I think that the Israelis have to put together a team, or maybe independently of the Israelis, somebody, and I'd love to be part of it, needs to put together a team of specialists who will examine all of this footage immediately, as soon as it comes out, not wait, not do a movie a year later or 5 years later or whatever. So that's one thing that has to happen. The second thing, it seems to me, is that the rest of the world needs to understand, and this is a real problem, particularly in a post-colonial, post-modern world of really sort of shabby thinkers. The rest of the world has to realize that there is a price to misperceiving reality. In other words, you know, you never get a pure picture of reality. I'm enough of a postmodernist to say there is no objectivity. But there is honesty and dishonesty, and if you can't filter out genuinely dishonest stuff, particularly malevolently dishonest stuff like Al-Dura and so on, then you are going to live in a world in which you misperceive what the forces are, and you will make critical decisions that are critically dangerous to you because you don't understand who you're dealing with. So, you know, this is probably not the kind of thing I should say on the air, but I really think that anti-Zionism, and Pallywood plays a key role in anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism right now is operating as a kind of cultural autoimmune deficiency syndrome. Europeans, the English are a really good example, are so enamored of being able to dump on Israel morally, of being able to point the finger and say, you Israelis, you think you're so good, but you're really awful. And, you know, you Jews, 2,000 years you've been oppressed, and no sooner you get power than you turn around and do it to others. And that feels so good that they're completely unaware that Israel is fighting against an enemy who is just as nasty in its designs on the Europeans as it is on the Israelis. So here they are looking at the Israelis and saying, you're the bad guys, the Palestinians are the innocent ones, you should deal with Hamas, and Hamas is part of an international, a global jihadi movement with ambitions to take over the whole world. And you say that to them, they go, don't be ridiculous. The only reason you're saying that is because you're a Zionist and you want to defend the Zionists. Well, if you can't pay attention to this kind of stuff, and if you're journalists, right, you know, considered a terrorist movement in quotes, the way Ben Waderman, I think, wrote in CNN recently, without informing you that there are genocidal passages in the charter of the Hamas movement. If your media has to lighten what these organizations are about in order for you to be able to dump on the Israelis, you're a babe in the woods. And that's what the Europeans are. The Europeans are literally committing suicide. Great book, The Suicide of Reason by Lee Harris. Brilliant book. And I think that the anti-Zionism that animates so much of the European attitude is a major part in their ability to understand what they're up against.
Richard, thank you very much for taking the time. And we'll hope for an update when there's something to update. Could you tell us a little about your website and what you have offered there?
Sure, thanks. One thing, you mentioned the weather. I do want to say one thing. I specialize in apocalyptic prophecies, apocalyptic beliefs. And right now there are two major apocalyptic beliefs that are out there in the public sphere. Normally apocalyptic beliefs, people saying Jesus is coming back tomorrow, that's marginalized. But there are two major apocalyptic fears out there. One is global warming, and one is global jihad. Unfortunately, what's happened is that one is left-wing and one is right-wing. And the people on the left say it's global warming and global jihad is a way of distracting us. And the people on the right say it's global jihad, and the people who say global warming are distracting us from what we have to deal with. In fact, they are intimately related through oil. Oil feeds global warming and oil feeds global jihad. And our addiction to oil is part of what makes us incapable of resisting what's going on. So I think that that itself gets at the core of our sickness, which is that the right and the left in the West are more intent on demonizing each other than they are in realizing that they're in the same ballpark, namely civil society, and they're facing a ferocious and nasty enemy. So that's that. As for my website, I have two websites. I have a website called The Second Draft, SecondDraftWith2Ds.org. And that is where I put up all the evidence on the Aldura case and on Pallywood. We're about to put up the Gaza Beach movie. There you can go. You can see videos. You can see what's going on. You can see the evidence. You can see our analysis of the evidence and so on. The other website is called theaugeanstables.com. Augean, A-U-G-E-A-N, and that's a blog. And I blog there with a very bright young man who was a BU student and came to Israel, served in the army, and is now back in the States. So he has some really interesting expertise on military matters and stuff. That's where we analyze. The Augean Stables is our symbol for the media, mainstream media, which is just so encrusted with bad habits that they stink up the whole peninsula. There we basically analyze on a sort of daily basis, draw people's attention to the way in which the media disorients us at a time where we can't afford to be disorient.
Thank you again, Richard.